Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. This week, episode 310, the Gnadenhütten Massacre. Following Yorktown, the British maintained their occupied cities in New York, Charleston, and Savannah, as well as the territories that today make up Canada and Florida. But they really, at this point, no longer planned to go on the offensive. London made very clear that it would not provide more soldiers for any offensive. Britain did, however, provide support to any Indian tribes who wanted to continue the fight with the Americans. One region that was still under contention was what we know today as the state of Ohio. Britain occupied a stronghold just north of the region in Detroit. The Continentals held key outposts to the south in what is today Kentucky, but their main outpost was at Fort Pitt in what is today western Pennsylvania. The area in between was almost entirely Indian tribes. No settlers dared try to occupy that land. When a French-speaking frontiersman entered the territory in 1780 with hopes of taking Detroit from the British, he and his men were massacred by the Miami Indians led by Chief Little Turtle. Those frontiersmen not killed in the battle suffered slow, torturous deaths at the hands of their captors. And we went over all that back in episode 271. The massacre was meant to send a message to stay out of Ohio, and for the most part it worked. White settlers largely stayed out of Ohio. And one exception to this were the Moravians. The religious group that traces its origins back to the 1400s in what is today the Czech Republic, they came to America in the early 1700s, first trying to set up communities in Georgia and the West Indies, but eventually giving up on those and focusing on Pennsylvania. They named their first two communities in Pennsylvania after the biblical towns of Bethlehem and Nazareth. From there, the members began to spread out across several colonies. Although the Moravian name came from the region in Europe where they originated, the members of the church called themselves the Unity of the Brethren. This pacifist sect hoped to avoid doctrinal fights, simply calling on members to live their lives as Jesus did. The members held strong evangelical passions, hoping to convert others to join their communities, and they set up missions among the Native Americans. One of their leading clergymen was David Zeisberger. Born in Moravia in 1721, Zeisberger came to Georgia with his family at the age of 6. By age 18, he was a leading figure in establishing the Moravian settlement at Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Several years later, the young man went to live among the Mohawk to learn their language. He ended up learning several native languages and began to focus on a life as a missionary to the Native Americans. He received ordination as a Moravian minister in 1749 and began living and working among the Lenape, who were also known as the Delaware, who lived in Pennsylvania. By 1772, Zeisberger had established a Moravian community made up of Delaware and Muncie families. They founded a town in Ohio along the Tuscarawas River, which they called New Schönbrunn, which means fine spring. Shortly thereafter, following more immigration into the Ohio Territory from Native American families in Pennsylvania, as well as more Delaware converts from tribes already in Ohio, the Moravians established a nearby town just downriver named Gnadenhütten. By the time the Revolution began, Zeisberger, in his 50s, was well established in Ohio country. In early 1776, he helped to establish a third community in Ohio called Lichtenau. Zeisberger and several other missionaries established new homes there. Zeisberger and his fellow clergy, as well as the natives with whom they lived, tried to live as pacifists who would not take sides in any war. They found this increasingly hard to do, as both sides in the war demanded they become an ally or be considered an enemy. In the early part of the war, Lieutenant Governor Henry Hamilton, among other things, served as the British Indian agent in Detroit. He convinced many of the tribes around him to support the king against the American rebels. These tribes engaged in raiding parties into western Pennsylvania, and further south into what is today Kentucky. As I described in an earlier episode, the Virginia militia under George Rogers Clark captured Hamilton and carried him back to Virginia as a prisoner of war in 1779. After more than a year, Hamilton was paroled to British-occupied New York, but once he was exchanged in 1781, he sailed for London. Although he returned to Quebec in 1782, he did not go back to take command of Detroit. Instead, command in Detroit went to Arendt Schuyler De Peyster, a loyalist from a Dutch New York family. De Peyster was a distant cousin of General Philip Schuyler, but the two men have obviously gone in very different directions. De Peyster had received a commission in the British Army in 1755. During the French and Indian War, he was taken prisoner and sent to France. After being exchanged, he continued to serve in the British Army in Germany for the remainder of the Seven Years' War. He remained a British regular officer and returned to America only when his regiment was transferred to Canada. Just before the Revolution began, De Peyster became commandant of Fort Michilimackinac, which is in what is today Michigan. After Hamilton's capture, Major De Peyster took command at Detroit. As was the policy of his predecessors, De Peyster provided aid to the tribes around the region of Detroit and encouraged them to attack rebel settlements to the south and east. He was known to buy prisoners from the Indians, which not only encouraged more attacks, but it also encouraged the Indians to bring the prisoners back alive rather than simply killing them. By late 1781, Detroit was holding hundreds of American prisoners. Given the poor state of Detroit's defenses, De Peyster knew that his primary defense was the hostile and active native warriors between Detroit and the Americans in Kentucky and Pennsylvania. The closest American base to this theater was the Continental Garrison at Fort Pitt, what we today call Pittsburgh. When we last looked at Fort Pitt, Colonel Daniel Broadhead was commanding. You may recall that Broadhead grew up in eastern Pennsylvania. He was a committed patriot who received a commission as lieutenant colonel in the Continental Army in 1776. He fought in the New York campaign with distinction. After his regimental commander was killed, he became colonel and led the 8th Pennsylvania Regiment through the Philadelphia campaign of 1777. Following the winter at Valley Forge, Broadhead and his regiment were assigned to Fort Pitt in the summer of 1778. When General Lachlan McIntosh led the failed attack into the Ohio Territory in 1779, Broadhead was one of his regimental commanders. After McIntosh was recalled, Colonel Broadhead took command of Fort Pitt. After taking command, Broadhead led several of his own campaigns into Ohio Territory, as well as into New York, to battle various tribes that were allied with the British. In the spring of 1781, Broadhead led an expedition against the Delaware in central Ohio. His expeditionary force, which included both Continentals and militia, wiped out the town of Coshocton, which was about 100 miles west of Fort Pitt. It forced many local tribes to flee eastern Ohio and move toward Detroit. It also put many of them decidedly out of the neutral camp and into the British camp. Now, shortly after his return from this campaign, Broadhead learned that he was being replaced as the commander at Fort Pitt. He had been accused of the misuse of funds, and he had to travel to Philadelphia to resolve the issue. After the matter was resolved in his favor, Broadhead returned to Fort Pitt in August. His second-in-command, Colonel John Gibson, had not received orders to return command to Broadhead and therefore refused to do so. Broadhead had Gibson arrested. After a time, General Washington wrote to make clear that Broadhead did not, in fact, have authority to retake command of Fort Pitt and ordered him to return command to Gibson. At that point, Gibson had Broadhead arrested. Apparently nothing came of those charges, since shortly afterward, Broadhead returned east and received a brevet to Brigadier General from George Washington. Gibson did not last long in that command either. In the fall of 1781, shortly after Washington recalled Broadhead, General William Irving received orders from Congress to take command of the entire Western Theater, which was headquartered at Fort Pitt. Now, Irving had grown up in what is today central Pennsylvania. He began war as a colonel and a regimental commander. His first mission was part of the Quebec Campaign of early 1776. During that campaign, he was wounded and taken prisoner. He received parole and returned to his home in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He wouldn't actually be exchanged until the spring of 1778. When he was, he returned to service under General Anthony Wayne and led his regiment at Monmouth. As an aside, Irving commanded the 7th Pennsylvania Regiment, which included Sergeant John Hayes, and of course Sergeant Hayes' wife was Mary Ludwig Hayes, who we commonly know today as Molly Pitcher. Now, the following spring, Irving received his promotion to Major General, following the resignation of another Pennsylvania general, Thomas Mifflin. Irving continued to serve on the Pennsylvania line under General Wayne. He appears to have remained in New Jersey when General Wayne took much of the rest of the Pennsylvania line into Virginia in 1781. It was around this time that Irvine received his orders to go to Fort Pitt and take command of the Western Department. So, during the time of the events that I'm about to discuss, the Continental leadership in the West was in flux. We have the command fight between Colonels Broadhead and Gibson, then orders that Irvine is to take command, but Irvine doesn't actually arrive at the fort until the end of this story. As a result, there was no active and unified Continental command at Fort Pitt. In between the British in Detroit and the Americans at Fort Pitt, the Moravians did what they could to maintain their neutrality and to let everyone know that their pacifism rendered them of no threat to anyone. Moravian leaders gladly signed agreements with the Americans that they would remain neutral. The British were not exactly content with their neutrality, but since the Moravians were much closer to the Americans, they hoped that would be enough. Many other tribes were taking sides, and they expected their neighbors to stand by them in battle. By 1777, Moravian villages learned that many of the tribes who had allied themselves with the British would not accept their neutrality. Failure to promise loyalty to Britain made one an enemy of Britain. Over the course of 1778 and 79, most Moravian communities abandoned their eastern communities and moved to the newer one that was further west at Lichtenau. This was farther away from either of where the combatants were raiding, but it was also much deeper into the central area of Delaware control. In 1777, a group of Wyandot warriors came to Lichtenau with the intent of killing or kidnapping the Moravian missionaries in hopes of getting the Moravian Indians to join the war. The Moravians responded by providing a feast for the Wyandot. This seemed to appease the warriors, who ended up leaving the community intact. The Delaware chiefs signed a treaty with the Americans that promised continued neutrality, but even within the Delaware nation, there were many subgroups opposed to this measure and wanted to pick a side. Many Wyandot and Mingo warriors marched through this area on the way to attack American frontier settlements. As I said, the Moravians were pacifists and neutral and did not join them. They also did nothing to stop them either. In fact, they regularly supplied war parties with food, shelter, and supplies, thus indirectly aiding the attacks on settlements. In some instances, Moravians warned Americans of approaching war parties, but they did nothing further to get involved. Over the course of the war, many Moravians returned to their original communities, the ones that were further east at New Schönbrunn and Gnadenhütten, where they had homes and fields. Staying away from their farms created the risk of starvation. The larger Delaware Rift grew more distinct, and many Delaware moved closer to Fort Pitt in hopes of receiving American protection from the pro-British war parties. Some of these warriors even joined the Continental Army. The growing divisions among the Delaware led to the increasing isolation of the Moravians. In the spring of 1781, back when Colonel Broadhead was still in command at Fort Pitt and led the raiding party into Ohio, his goal was primarily to appease the militia from the area whose families had been victims of Indian raids. While clearing out hostile Indians, the Broadhead party at that time marched to the Moravian community at Salem. Knowing they were pacifists, Broadhead sent a messenger asking the Moravian leaders to come to his camp. When one of the missionaries did so, Broadhead discussed his operations and asked for the locations of other Moravians so that he could avoid attacking them. The missionary complied, and Broadhead managed to lead a successful raid against the Delaware town of Neshocton. He also managed to steer clear of the Moravians. Some of his militia, however, were not so concerned about which Indians were really a threat and which were not, kind of that the only good Indian is a dead Indian mindset. Colonel Broadhead had to place his Continentals between several Moravian villages and militia who were bent on destroying them. Now, thanks to Colonel Broadhead's firm action, the militia also passed over these communities. Now, later that summer, a rather large war party made up of the Delaware and a few other Western tribes came through the region under the direction of a British officer. This group tried to force the Moravians to move to Detroit and sought to take the missionaries by force. They managed to capture Zeisberger and at least one other missionary, and those two men were taken to Detroit. Now, these warriors did what they could to encourage the Moravian Indians to leave. They destroyed crops, livestock, and looted their homes, but the pacifist Indians refused to fight back and also refused to join them. Eventually, most of them agreed to move further west into the British area of control. Since they were removed in the fall and had no opportunity to harvest crops, many were on the verge of starvation. Although the British had promised to provide supplies, once they got there, they found that the British only wanted to provide supplies to the families of warriors willing to join British-led war parties. A short time after the British removal, American militia, under Colonel David Williamson, also raided the Moravian communities with the intent of moving them back to Fort Pitt. Now, the Americans were surprised to find the communities were largely abandoned and only captured a handful of people who had avoided the British dragnet. Over the course of the winter, many hungry Moravian Indians ended up returning to these abandoned towns, hoping to harvest and store the corn that remained ungathered in their fields. These people lived in the woods rather than in their houses in order to avoid being captured and removed once again. Also during the winter months, particularly in February, the British-backed warriors conducted a great many raids on frontier settlements and individual houses around Fort Pitt. They would often hit isolated farmhouses, murdering families and taking scalps. In an effort to intimidate, the raiding parties would often mutilate bodies. One war party returned from a raid that passed through Gnadenhütten on their return. They informed some of the Moravian Indians that they had captured a woman and a child from a farm and impaled the two on stakes on the western side of the Ohio River. They informed the Moravians of this because they warned that the militia would likely be headed after them in a retaliatory raid. And retaliation was exactly what the militia had in mind. They knew that the Moravian Indians at Gnadenhütten were storing corn, which could be used to feed these raiding parties that were killing their families. On March 4th, 1782, a militia force of about 160 men under the command of Colonel Williamson mustered with the intent of eliminating these Moravian villages. Fort Pitt at this time was in a state of disarray from the change of commanders. It didn't approve the raid, but it also didn't send any soldiers to stop anyone. The fort commander tried to send a warning to the Moravian communities, but also did nothing to stop the militia or even try to control them. On March 6th, the militia had surrounded a Moravian community and attacked it from multiple sides. Moravian villagers, as usual, did not resist, and they didn't run either. They believed they were neutrals and would not be harmed. That was not the case. The first Moravian they came across was a man named Joseph Shabash, a man of European descent. The militia murdered and scalped him. Next, they came upon a group of Indians working in the cornfields. This larger group they escorted to town, saying that they were going to be taken to Fort Pitt as prisoners. The militia killed several more individuals whom they encountered, but when they came across larger groups, they moved them into the town of Gnadenhütten, and there they took away any items that could be used as weapons. They tied up the prisoners and put them in two houses, one for the men and the other for the women and children. The militia also took the nearby town of Salem, capturing the Indians there, and removing those prisoners back to Gnadenhütten as well. The militia continued to round up Moravian families, who, as I said, seemed cooperative, and still being told that they were just being removed to Fort Pitt. The Indians who remained tied up inside the two houses remained compliant, sitting bound, praying, and singing Christian hymns as the militia collected more work parties still out in the distant fields. As the militia secured the Moravians, they talked among themselves about the property they had confiscated from them. It included farm equipment, cooking utensils, horses, etc. Many of the militia were convinced that the only way that the Indians could have these things would be if they had participated in the raids against their settlements. The militia held some sort of sham trial where the Moravian Indians protested their innocence and made clear they had purchased what they owned, just like any other people would do over many years of working and farming. The militia determined that all of these prisoners needed to die. The men voted, and only about 16 or 18 voted not to kill all of their prisoners. And realizing that they were in the minority, these men simply left. The remainder of the militia got to work. The first separated out a group of prisoners that they believed to be warriors, and these were marched out of town and executed. The remaining prisoners, mostly women and children, had their skulls bashed in with a mallet, one by one. A militiaman would walk up to the next prisoner who was tied up, still singing and praying, and would bash his skull in and kill him, then move on to the next one. when that militiaman got tired, somebody else would take his place and continue bashing in the skulls of men, women, and children. After they were killed, each body was scalped. In all, 96 men, women, and children were executed. The militia then burned the two houses with the bodies still in them. The primary witnesses of events were two boys who managed to survive the massacre. One of them had been scalped and left for dead, but managed to hide under a pile of dead bodies before escaping the house after dark and before it was set on fire. Another boy managed to hide in the cellar of the home and then escape through a window after the house was set on fire. A word spread quickly of the massacre, and many returned to the village to see the remains for themselves. Zeisberger was already on his way to Detroit by the time he received word. He hoped that it was an exaggeration and that most of his people had been taken back to Fort Pitt, only to learn later that all of them had in fact been killed. The militia returned to Pennsylvania, along with the scalps and items they had looted from their victims. At Fort Pitt, there were no consequences. General Irvine appears not to have arrived at Fort Pitt to take command until late March, several weeks after the massacre had already occurred. He seemed displeased with the massacre, but did nothing about it. He needed to rely on these militia for the defense of the fort. He noted that many of the militia wanted to kill Colonel Gibson, his predecessor, for being too friendly with the Indians. Even after the militia killed two more friendly Delaware who had sought refuge near the fort, General Irvine did nothing. He simply reported the matter to General Washington without any recommendation for further action. For the Continental Army, this matter was best forgotten. Next week, we're going to head to the West Indies, where British and French fleets once again pick up the fight over island colonies. Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show, part of the Airwave Media Network. Thanks to my Patreon supporters and the Alexander Hamilton Club, George Davis, Mike Hager, John Celentano, Michael Mulhern, and the Sons of the American Revolution. And you can check out the SAR podcast at fastfunhistory.com. Thanks also to Robert Morris Circle supporters, TJ Walker, and Curtis Johnson. Welcome also to SM Kling, our newest Privy Council member on Patreon. Among other benefits, you get a new magnet each month from the American Revolution. Most importantly, you are helping this podcast to continue. Also, thanks to everyone who provides ongoing contributions via Patreon or through one-time gifts via PayPal or Venmo. The Gnadenhütten Massacre essentially ended the Moravian experiment of having Europeans and Native Americans living together in a Christian community. There are still many Moravian communities in Ohio and around the world, but my understanding is that the Ohio communities, even the one at Gnadenhütten today, are largely made up of people of European heritage. The events, understandably, made many Native Americans less trustful of white Europeans. In a future Indian war, the chief, Tecumseh, was negotiating with General William Henry Harrison and actually brought up the Gnadenhütten Massacre. He said, quote, "You recall the time when the Jesus Indians of the Delawares lived near the Americans and had confidence in their promises of friendship and thought they were secure. Yet the Americans murdered all the men, women, and children, even as they prayed to Jesus." Tecumseh was obviously making the point that Indians had a hard time trusting whites because of incidents like that. Zeisberger and many Moravian Indians remained away from the site of the massacre, living near Detroit for the next few years. The Moravians were known as the Praying Indians because of their devotion to Christianity. They built a new village called New Gnadenhütten. Many of these people eventually moved up into Canada. They wanted to return to their original homes, but could not do so for many reasons. They finally got U.S. approval to return in 1798. About 25 years later, the U.S. repurchased the lands and forced their removal once again. Some of the militia who engaged in the massacre later had second thoughts about what they had done. One quote I came across when writing this said, quote, "Nathan Rollins had tomahawked 19 of the poor Moravians, and after it was over, he sat down and cried and said it was no satisfaction for the loss of his father and uncle after all." I have to say, when I discuss issues like these massacres or other issues with moral implications like slavery, I really try hard to keep from interjecting my own personal judgments on the issue. My view is that if the facts don't lead you to your own moral conclusions, my opinion probably won't matter anyway. I try to let the facts speak for themselves. I hope that by doing this, no one concludes that I don't have my own opinions about these events. Of course I do, but I'm not trying to present those here. When I'm reading issues like this, my real curiosity is understanding what led people to commit these acts. Whatever our thoughts are about the actions taken by the militia, it's interesting to me to understand what led them to the actions that they actually took. In this case, the Native warriors were attacking their homes, massacring their families, and committing other brutal acts. Those natives, of course, believe the attacks necessary to prevent encroachments onto their land. But from the perspective of the militia, it was not time for some larger debate about land justice. It was about protecting their families and preventing further such attacks on their own communities. The Moravian Indians, in their minds, may or may not have been participants in the attacks, but they were certainly providing aid and support to the attackers. This is similar to the mindset of those who attacked the neutral Iroquois tribes during the Sullivan campaign, which I discussed in an earlier episode. Again, I'm not trying to justify these actions, I'm just trying to get into the heads of the men who committed these acts to understand why they did what they did. For me, judging any historical act is pointless. Understanding why it happened and how it impacted other events is much more of what I want to understand. I hope that comes through. Now, there are quite a few books about the Gnadenhutten Massacre. It's interesting to see how the events are covered in older books that were written in the 1800s versus books written in the last couple of decades. While the facts are the same, there is a great difference in the way they are portrayed. I've included a long list of both old and new books in my blog entry for this episode, so if this topic interests you, you might want to check out some of these yourself. As I always do, I've picked out one book for my recommendation. This week, it's David Zeisberger, A Life Among the Indians, by Earl Olmsted. This book is a comprehensive look at Zeisberger's decades-long efforts to set up Moravian communities that had the settlers and natives living and working together in peaceful Christian communities. And the book ends with the Gnadenhutten Massacre. This book was published in 1997. The author is an Ohio historian who passed away in 2013. If you want to read more about this, check out David Zeisberger, A Life Among the Indians, by Earl Olmsted. My online recommendation was kind of a tough choice this week because there are so many good online resources. Among them was an available thesis on the massacre, which provides a great summary of events if you want to learn more about the incident itself. However, when I can, I like to focus my recommendations on primary resources, and that's why I've chosen The Diary of David Zeisberger, a Moravian Missionary Among the Indians of Ohio. This is a pretty lengthy two-volume book that begins in 1781, only months before the massacre, and then follows Zeisberger through many years following the events. It's a great resource, written by someone who actually lived through the events that we covered today. As always, I've included direct links to the book on archive.org, on my blog and website. My question this week asks, which was a better musket, the British Brown Bess or the French Charleville? Well, the two muskets were actually pretty similar. The Charleville is named for a town in France where they were first made and was developed for the army in 1717. It has a 69 caliber musket, weighed about 10 pounds, and was about 5 feet long. Now, the Brown Bess name is of questionable origin. The best explanation I've seen is that it was an adaption of a 17th century term. The term Bess was used generally to describe a common woman. The term Brown Bess usually referred to a woman of loose virtue or a street prostitute. Shortly after the musket was put into service in 1722, the term Hugging Brown Bess became used as a slang term for joining the army. The Brown Bess musket itself was a 75 caliber musket. It was about a half pound heavier than the Charleville, and its barrel was usually a few inches shorter, but the length of the barrel varied across several different versions of the musket. Both guns, the Charleville and the Brown Bess, had about the same range and firing rate. The Brown Bess range may have been slightly longer, but it was not really enough to be a significant tactical advantage. In short, the two guns were not terribly different in terms of effectiveness on the battlefield. Both were in service for more than a century through the Napoleonic Wars. By the mid-1800s, both muskets were being phased out and replaced by percussion cap rifles. The Minet rifle in France came into common use with the Minet ball, which gave the accuracy of the rifle combined with the speed of a musket. Britain quickly copied this technology with the introduction of the Enfield rifle a few years later. If you have a question you'd like me to answer, please reach out to me either via email or on Twitter, Facebook, Quora, or Reddit. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.